Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. The Umbrella Hour is brought to you by the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. This is a program from which I graduated. Many of the students at the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, also known as IICS, are able to go on and establish themselves as sex therapists. You'll hear more about them in the upcoming commercial because they are our sponsors. Your hosts are Dr. On, board-certified clinical sexologist, and Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. I'm going to hand this over to Xander.
Thank you, On. Yes, it is a privilege and an honor to be able to introduce our guest today. Our guest is Rupert Raj. Rupert is a Eurasian Canadian trans elder, a pioneering community activist, a former therapist and gender consultant, a published author, memoirist, and poet. We have so much we're going to be talking about during this hour. Welcome to the show, Rupert.
Thank you, Xander.
Absolutely. Why don't we get started by having you just talk to us a little bit about when did your trans activism begin? What was going on in your life at that time? And what were you doing?
Okay. I was 19, living in Ottawa, Canada's capital. And I started my transition from female to male in October 71, when I got my first male hormone shot from Dr. Charles Allenfeld in New York, Harry Benjamin's associate. And so then I started university at the same time in my male persona. So I was using the name Nicholas Gosch then. That was the name I adopted for myself. And then later on in 1988, I changed it to Rupert Raj. So I started community activism by reaching out to other trans people. And in those days, we call them transsexuals and transvestites for trans women, trans men, non-binary and cross-dressers. So just getting together and trying to form community. Unfortunately, we didn't have a lot of venues open to us to meet, and the newspaper wouldn't let me advertise because they thought it was sexual, a classified ad, and I didn't want to go that route. So we did it by word of mouth through the queer community. So then in 1972, I had my top surgery with Dr. David Wesser in Yonkers, New York, and stayed with Mario Martino, who was the author of Emergence 1976, name was Tony Tornaby. I stayed at his place. My sister came down with me. I went to Toronto to meet the three trans women that started the first trans organization in Canada, which they started in 1970. And I saw them in 72. It was called Association for Canadian Transsexuals, or ACT for short. So then I worked with them and driving back and forth between Ottawa and Toronto at different times because I was still going to school full time, doing my bachelor's in psychology. So then we asked Zelda Supley, who was the secretary of the Erickson Education Foundation at that time, to come up from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to talk about EEF and present some pamphlets, which she did. We met at the old Homophile Community Center in Toronto at that time, which now I think is a Chinese church. Then I completed my BA in psych. In 1975, I moved to Vancouver and I started petitioning the provincial governments in Ontario and British Columbia to cover gender-confirming hormone therapy and surgeries for trans people, which I was unsuccessful at, even though I did get a lot of petition signatures from Canadian and American activists and health care workers. So then I moved to Calgary in 1979 because I found out that they were offering phalloplasty, bottom surgery, for trans men covered under the Alberta Health Insurance Plan if you had been a resident, a citizen or a resident for 3 months. Unfortunately, I didn't have the phalloplasty because I was only 100 pounds and they didn't have skin grafts quite to that sophisticated level. They said, do you want to end up with a pencil? I said, no, I will wait for a bit. So I had the hysterectomy. Oh, and at that time, I met trans women, trans men who were living there. In fact, some of them became partners or roommates, friends, and on, as I mentioned in my memoir. I founded the Foundation for the Advancement of Canadian Transsexuals in Calgary, FACT, F-A-C-T for short, in 1978. And my trans man partner, Chris Black, is the pseudonym, was my secretary. And then we had trans man who used the pseudonym, Kyle Spooner, who was our treasurer. And then I started Gender Review, the newsletter for FACT, which came out bi-monthly, starting in June 78. And I ran it for 3 years till 1981, till Susan Huxford took it over. I then moved back to Ontario, Ottawa for 2 months. Then I moved to Toronto and I brought FACT to Toronto. And we opened up many chapters in Ontario and Quebec and even upper state New York. Then I left FACT in the end of 1981. And in the beginning of 1982, I started Metamorphosis Counseling and Education Services, which focused only on trans men and their loved ones. And I put out a newsletter, a bi-monthly newsletter called Metamorphosis, which then morphed into a magazine, a quarterly magazine, Metamorphosis. Morphosis magazine. We had contributors from all across Canada, the US, and the UK. And I did professional profiles on a lot of the main healthcare professionals in Canada, in North America. I also corresponded with Lou Sullivan. We became pen pals. He joined my organization. We posted letters in each other's newsletters, and we also posted articles in each other's newsletters. And my papers are in the San Francisco Gay and Lesbian Historical Society under Lou's fonds, and his are in mine, my fonds, my papers at the Archives Canada's Two-Spirit LGBTQ Archives in Toronto, and also some of them may be at the University of Victoria Archives under the Transgender Archives and UVic Library in Victoria, Vancouver Island, British Columbia.
I wanted to say, one, wow, that's extraordinary, an extraordinary list of, I don't know, just contributions, pioneering contributions to specifically the FTM community or trans man community, the trans community as a whole. So I'm really happy to hear about all of that and also some of the linkages to, so the Erickson Education Foundation, right, which was founded by Reed Erickson, who's a trans man that many people have never even heard of. And I highly encourage people to look him up. But I know there's a website that has a really good history of him that's been done by Aaron DeVore, who is the chair of transgender studies at UVic that you mentioned and where they have those archives. But then also you mentioned Mario Martino, the author of Emergence, and a lot of people have never heard of him. I don't know if this is true. You probably do know. Is Emergence the first book written by a trans man about a trans man's life, like the first memoir written by a trans man, published at least?
Very good question. Well, it was one of the very earlier ones. Michael Lawrence Dillon wrote his memoir in 1962, but it didn't get published till after his death in, I forget the exact, I think it may have been in the 20s. He was a British doctor who transitioned from 1946 to 49, one of the first trans men that we know of who ever had phalloplasty done by an Australian surgeon done in Britain over 3 years. And he was also the first British person to be a Buddhist monk. Unfortunately, he died because of malnutrition and a vegetarian diet. There was also a couple of other British books written and published by intersex and or trans men, because it was sometimes, because as you know, Xander, some intersex people are trans and some trans people are intersex, as well as some Hijra or Two-Spirit are intersex. A lot of people don't realize that, and I've gone out of my way to try to write about that so people really understand how complex gender and sexual diversity is. And of course, there was a lot of discrimination against both transsexuals, intersex, two-spirit, non-binary, and still is to some degree. I did a list in a bibliography in my first and second memoir, 2017 memoir and the 2020 memoir, Dancing the Dialectic, True Tales of a Transgender Trailblazer. The second edition is published in 2020 by Transgender Publishing, which is now called Perceptions Press, done by Professor Margot Wilson in Victoria, BC. So I did an extensive intersectional bibliography in that memoir.
Yeah, that's fantastic, because I've noticed along the years that even when I was part of the lesbian community, I noticed it not as much as I've noticed it in the last 20-something years in trans community, is a lack of knowledge of the history, right? The people, the places, the organizations, the magazines, the gatherings, all of these different opportunities for people to connect. I still hear people today, a variety of ages, who will say things like, well, I just couldn't find anything, so I had to start it. And I was like, what do you mean you didn't find anything? Like the internet, I think what's happening, Rupert, is I think that there are so many results that show up when you do an internet search that it might be overwhelming. And you also don't know how to determine what is a reputable or current or local, right, resource, unless you know how to properly do a search. Like I was taught, you were probably taught, Ann was probably taught how to do that in the library, right? But a lot of people just put in like transgender in the internet. Well, that's going to get millions of results. So I think that that's part of it. The other is I remember doing, and things are probably different, I hope they are now, but I remember even 10 years ago, just for a project doing something like transgender history in a Google search. And I got to tell you, I had to go a few pages in before there was anything that referenced FTMs or trans men. It was all trans women. woman and trans female MTF related. So I hope that has changed. So I like that there's this place where people can go. And I want you to talk in a little bit about your memoirs, because I want people to be able to know, like, there are places where you can go. You can not only read about Rupert's life and the things that he's been involved in and started, but also the different people you met and the books you read that are going to predate a lot of what you're writing. And so that's going to be really helpful for people. I just want to add a little tidbit, because I'm not sure if you know this, the Wikipedia page for Michael Dillon, you were referencing Dr. Dillon. I read the book about him called The First Man-Made Man by Pagan Kennedy before his book was published, which I think was 2017, around there. And I was reading that entry for him in Wikipedia, noticed that it didn't mention anything about his phalloplasty. So I went in and edited it and added in that it was years ago. It was years ago that I did that. And so, and it's never been removed because they've been able to verify it or confirm it through a lot of other publications. But I did that when we were doing the Hung Jury book, which is a book that I did with Transgress Press. And I included Michael Dillon's story. I got permission from Pagan Kennedy to take out all of the excerpts from her book that were just about his phalloplasty surgery, his back and forth with the doctor from medical school. And so I typed that up by hand and put it into Hung Jury while we were working on that book. And that's when I added it to the Wikipedia. So that was probably around 2011, 12, something like that.
Good for you, Sandra.
Yeah.
Did you know there was another bio prior to that? Liz Hodgkinson did a bio on Michael Lawrence Dillon. I donated a whole bunch of books to my funds at the Toronto Archives, I think, including that one. And the problem when people do these searches is, for example, the Wikipedias that we get here in North America are mostly done by Americans. So it's very Americentric, very rarely done by Canadians or Mexicans or British. And so I looked at some of the Wikipedia and there's a huge, huge, huge gaps about Canadian history. Just incredible. So it's basically, Wikipedia is basically about American history. I don't know what they access in other countries outside of North America. I sent 50 important trans Canadians to Professor Elspeth Brown, who's a professor at U of T and University of Toronto. And she's also on the board of the archives in Toronto. And she's on the Oral LGBT Collaboratory History, the Trans Oral History Project, which has videos on both the Victoria Archives and the Toronto Archives to try to make a broader picture. For example, the Association for Canadian Transsexuals 1970 was started at the same time as STAR, Street Transvestite Activists, I forgot what the R stands for, that Sylvia Rivera and Marsha Johnson started in New York. So while that was going on, ACT was also going on, but we didn't really know of each other that much because we didn't have the internet. I used to do phone calls and letters, millions of letters that I typed or by hand, or phone calls that were very expensive. So, you know, it was hard to connect, but that's where the newsletters, and there was a person at UVic that's supposed to be writing about the early newsletters, Kimmy Dominique, I think. They were the lifeline before the electronic bulletin boards came out in Sunnyvale, California, with, I forgot their name now, the one who did Golden Gate Girls, Golden Guys, Golden Gate Girls.
Oh, yeah. Lynn Conway?
No, it wasn't her.
No.
I just forgot the name. Lou Sullivan was part of that.
Oh, that's right. I was thinking, Lynn Conway was the computer engineer. That's why I was going in that direction. But that's right. The organization in the Bay Area that Lou Sullivan is another person that you mentioned that not a lot of people are familiar with. There's more people are becoming familiar, at least with an FTM community or trans masculine, AFAB, non-binary community, becoming familiar with Lou Sullivan because a couple of people curated or collated some of his more erotic poems or writings from all of his journals over his lifetime and put it into one book. There's also another book about his life that was
by
written,
Bryce Smith,
by Bryce, because they wrote their dissertation on Lou. As a matter of fact, when I was part of FTM International, I was on the board when I was in San Francisco, and Bryce came to us and asked us for funds to be able to pay to make photocopies of items from Lou's archive that were part of not only the Historical Society, but also the archives that are at the San Francisco Public Library at the Civic Center branch. There's an archive there that is, it's something like the something Hormel. I think one of the Hormel family members is a gay man, like Hormel chili, right? Mm-hmm. So it's named after one of their family members. And so We gave him a few $100 to be able to do that work. And right. So it's just, you had mentioned fact and act and metamorphosis and.
Oh, and I never mentioned Gender Worker. I forgot about that. 1988. And I did two newsletter issues, Gender Networker. Can I just tell you one thing so I don't forget, Xander? I included Lou Sullivan's poem that he wrote in 1976 or something, something from the To the Girl Within. I included his poem in my poetry anthology of Souls and Roles of Sex and Gender, a Treasury of Transsexual, Transvestic, and Transgenderist Verse from 1967 to 1991, which I donated to Dr. Aaron DeVore, and they uploaded it to the Transgender Archives in Victoria and also to KJ Rawson's Digital Transgender Archive in Boston. Oh, and sorry, and the previous version, the print version, was donated to my funds at the Toronto Archives. So we did get Lou's early poem, which I also published in my newsletter. I think it was the Metamorphosis newsletter.
I wanted to mention too that what I hear a lot as an academic is Wikipedia. Obviously, we can't steer our students to Wikipedia because it's not valid. But I have found that the people who contribute to Wikipedia, the ones who you can trace and verify, have done a phenomenal job in providing information that I don't think the average person in the US would really be knowledgeable about. It's a shame that we, as I suppose in the academic world, we don't really pay much heed to it, but there is a lot to be gained from it. I also sent a chat just letting you know that it's Wikimedia Europe. I'm from Europe. I thought it was an interesting question you raised because apparently they have their own Wikimedia in Europe. And I was looking up to see what they had in Asia. And it doesn't look like they actually have I'm just doing a quick search here. That may not be something you want to hang your hat on, but they do have their own versions in their own languages.
Oh, that's good to know. I'm also on Wikipedia and the Canadian Encyclopedia online.
Rupert, when you were in New York and I believe you said you stayed with Mario. I know that's not his
Tony Tornabene
name. Yeah. Yeah. Could you just tell us a little bit about Mario? The only thing I know about him is his book. And I don't know what happened to him. I've talked with Jameson Green. I think he lost track of him at a certain point as well. But I'm wondering, what can you tell us about some of these early pioneers, people that were transitioned by the time you were coming up and you were starting what you were doing, what their lives were like?
Yeah, so I believe I came across Mario through the Erickson Educational Foundation because, you know, I would write to them and say, do you have any contacts so for such and such? So Mario was, you know, a former nun, and then I gave that up, was living in New York at the time, was working in Yonkers Professional Hospital in Yonkers, New York, as a nursing supervisor in his male role. He underwent phalloplasty, I think, in 69, and it wasn't successful. So then he underwent it again in, I think, 1970 or thereabouts, and it took the next time. And he then started the Labyrinth Educational Counseling Service, which he sent out a fact sheet, but not really a newsletter, just like a one-page sheet. And what he was doing was offering his home, because his first wife was a nurse, who he later left and had a second wife. And he offered this to trans men who were coming to have surgery with Dr. Wetzer at Yonkers Professional Hospital to stay with him for 10 days or so. They paid a nominal fee. My sister came down with me to support me, so that was great. We each had our own room. And so, you know, so he could, because in those days you had to stay in the hospital, I think, for 3 days, and there was a drainage tubes and you had bandages and all that, but they have a different procedure now, I think. So he and his wife would make sure that there's no infections and clean up everything. So he did that, but he also was trying to get which I wrote about in my memoir, the penile prosthetic device, the PPD, which he had a prototype. So it would be, I think it was made of silicone or something like that. And he had a pinkish, whitish color and a black color version. So it would be used to stand up to urinate, stand to pee, and also for sexual penetration with inserting a stiffening rod. So a dual purpose. Unfortunately, it was unsuccessful because, as you know, the problems of uric acid and so on and so on. And he didn't have the funding or the whatever to carry on. So that's why I started Metamorphosis Medical Research Foundation, which was what Metamorphosis Counseling morphed into, because I was hoping to take that and carry it on from where Tony Tornabene left it off to develop it. Unfortunately, I was not successful because I couldn't get the funding and so on and so on. You know, now there's a lot more funding for a lot of things, not so much back in the 70s and 80s. And so unfortunately, we had to leave that. And then in the 90s, there was a German guy, I forgot his name, I mentioned in my memoir, and there was a couple of American trans men that fashioned their own, what they call standard P, either P only or penetration only or combination. And so it's a little bit more sophisticated, those devices. So Mario then moved to Florida, I forget exactly when, I think in the 70s, because he retired from his activism and his profession. And then I think he died in the 70s. There is a Wikipedia on him. Unfortunately, not all the Wikipedias are totally accurate or have all the information. So I lost touch with him as well, you know, before he moved to Florida. But I do have a signed copy of his memoir, which I donated to the Toronto Archives.
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. Our guest this hour is Rupert Raj, who is a Eurasian Canadian trans elder, pioneering community activist, former therapist, and gender consultant, published author, memoirist, and poet. Don't go away. We'll be back shortly.
The station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movements and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. And our guest this hour is Rupert Raj, a Eurasian Canadian trans elder, pioneering community activist, former therapist, and gender consultant, published author, memoirist, and poet. Let's get back to the show.
That's wonderful. Did you ever meet Lou Erickson? Reed Erickson.
Oh, sorry. Okay. No, we didn't meet because I had no money to travel. I was working minimum wage for many, many, many years, even though I had a BA in psych. You can't get a job unless you have a master's or greater. So no, but we corresponded and he gave me some of his newspaper clippings, which I donated to my fonds at the archives. And Zelda Supley had several scrapbooks. She gave me, I think, three, and she gave Dallas Denny some scrapbooks from EEF, which Dallas put in her, I think it's her Michigan archives. or wherever it is, University of Michigan, which her archives are also at the Transgender Archives, Dallas Denny. So he was wanting to know about legally marrying somebody or some stuff. And then, as you know, he got into all that stuff about the ransom and John Money sent over the German Krugers to ransom him out and all of that. And he got involved with drugs and a whole other thing. Baron DeVore and Nick Matt wrote all about that. Well, about it, yeah.
Yeah. Something like living in Mexico with a menagerie of wild animals and things.
Yeah. Who's the character? Apparently Tony Tornabene, who also went by Mary Martino, met Eric Reed when Reed was 54. I forget what year that was, because I believe Reed was albino and had a kind of a high voice. And Mario said to me, geez, I wasn't impressed. Unfortunately, Mario did a lot of good stuff, but he was also kind of judgmental. Like he didn't like the hairy legs of the trans women that he saw at the hospital. He was a bit trans misogynist, put it that way. He wasn't a feminist, put it that way. And he wasn't so wonderfully accepting of other trans men, including me. So, you know, people have their personalities, as you know, politics and personalities.
Interesting. Yeah.
Why was that, Rupert? I mean, when I look at you, I see a guy. Was it beyond that? What do you think that was about?
Well, for those of us in the trans community or the queer community, or I guess any community, there's often a lot of rivalry and jealousy and infighting, whether it's in the academic production or the activist production. Egos, unfortunately, there's a lot of egos. We had two trans marches. One was a rogue march in Toronto, and then in Vancouver, the same thing. And all over the world, I've seen that. And in the early days, the queer and the trans community parted until AIDS brought them back together again. You know, when you're a marginalized population, we tend to eat our own and we tend to butt heads against those that are very like us. Many, not all of us, but many of us, unfortunately, instead of uniting to fight the common enemy.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you made the comment about his voice, it just caught my attention, because the only way that I can think of being comfortable with my voice is when I'm either laying down or when I'm in a sitting position. And Xander's heard me talk about this. Outside of that, I am who I am, and there's nothing going to change that. Not after all these years of being on hormones. I just think some trans guys just don't have those receptor sites for whatever reason.
Yeah, I know some trans guys with higher voices. It's okay. It's the same with cis men. Some cis men have feminine features, the way the genetics and the chromosomes and the hormones play out.
Absolutely.
I remember in 2007, I started writing a blog called The Tao of Transition. I was trying to use Taoist principles to talk about what I was experiencing. And one of the posts that I made, I talked about the paradox of gender and how I had come to the conclusion that this whole thing about gender was one big game, that I went from being too masculine as a woman for many kinds of people. And then a couple years into my transition medically, I was perceived as too feminine for a man by other kinds of people. And I thought, you know what? I'm done. I'm done playing the gender game. I didn't play it because I was a butch dyke. So I didn't play the gender game. And I thought, I'm not going to start playing it now. Right. So when people say to me, oh, but you look and you sound very masculine, I'm like, well, that's just testosterone, because these are the genetics that I have. But the way I dress is exactly the same as how I dressed before I started my medical transition. I didn't become the kind of person who changed my wardrobe and changed my interests and my hobbies and activities. I just went on testosterone and just physically started to change. I said, I'm not going to play that game. And it bothers me when I encounter people or hear of other people in our community, so to speak, trans in that really broad way, that are policing people based on things like that, how they sound, how they dress, who they partner with. I remember hearing lots of stories about, for example, at the first FTMI conference, that there was this sneering, contemptuous attitude from the quote straight trans men towards the gay trans men. And it's like, this is just ridiculous. Why would we perpetuate and perpetrate all of the kinds of things that many of us have had to deal with, or know people who have had to deal with, prejudice and bias and discrimination, rejection, all of these things? Why would we do that to our own community? And I've looked at horizontal hostility. It's an academic concept that you can study. It comes out of the nursing field and on is a nurse, so might be very familiar with it. And so I just wonder if that same kind of environment that exists, I don't know about trans women's community because I'm not in it. And I don't know how they handle all of these issues, but I definitely have seen it within MTF or however people want to say it differently now. There's so many different ways. This same kind of horizontal hostility, which, I mean, it's probably not nice of me to say, but I'll say it anyways, is a very female way to act. Like, why would we do that, right? Why would we bring in that catfighting that I know men do it very differently, but I don't see that we're doing it within FTM community. I don't know that we're doing it in the way that men do it versus the way women do it. And maybe that's just part of the game and I'm way off base with this, but I just wish it didn't happen. It's very schoolyard behaviors, and I wish it would stop. And it's still happening today. It wasn't just then, 70s and 80s. It's still happening, and I wish it would stop. Yeah. And even when it's not happening to a person, they've heard about it from other people. But then there's the other issue of they think it might happen to them. There might be a sense of insecurity in their own masculinity, their own maleness, their own transness, and they think that everybody is judging them. They're doing some mind reading. And so it's going to impact people, whether it's directly happening to them or people they know, or they suspect it might be happening or think that it could be happening. And either way, it's going to destroy the cohesion of our community, because it could be a bigger movement. We probably could be making much bigger strides as a movement if we weren't so split apart or fractured. Yeah. At least that's my lens that I see it through.
I agree. Yeah.
I wrote about this in Gender Review 1978. I think it was September 1978. The oppressed is oppressor. And in those days, there was that hierarchy where the trans women would say, would call out the transvestites and the transvestites would call out the drag queens and the female impersonators. And some of the trans women would say, oh, you're not a real woman. Oh, look, I'm a walking, talking woman. In the Gender Journeys group that I co-facilitated with a trans colleague, one trans woman, one trans man at the Sherburn Health Center in Toronto, we had some people in the group that were complaining that some of the group members would look too femmy, and why would they use a male name or say they're trans, a trans man, if they look so femmy? Because there was this gender policing, sexual gender policing. And of course, there's sexual policing too. Because when I published Metamorphosis, I think I came out at that time as queer because I was living with a queer trans man in Vancouver. And then we lived in Calgary. And the straight trans men were really upset about that. Oh, you're so kinky. And then when I wrote about the trans people in prison, because I was supporting Michael Ashford, who had the TIP Transsexuals in Prison newsletter, and was supporting them and gave them free subscriptions to the Metamorphosis newsletter, I got negative comments from some of the trans men because they thought these people were trash, or, you know, it was classism or riffraff. But when you look at marginalized populations, there's always underserved people. They could be street active. They could be drug affected. They could be ex-cons, what have you. I mean, that goes without saying, the social determinants of health, discrimination, racism, homophobia, transphobia, poverty, homelessness. Anyway, a friend of mine recently said to me, oh, this must be mean girl syndrome, what you were just referring to, how some trans men or FTMs will call out others. And I had only come across this term mean girl syndrome just a year or two ago. I hadn't been aware of it till a cis queer friend of mine, who was a social worker, who wrote a paper with me on the informed consent model that I did and published, or not published, but uploaded to my our consulting website. She mentioned that to me as well. So I don't know. I know that some trans women and some gay and some drag queens, we had some that got into a cat fight at Sherburn Health Center where I worked. Some of the trans women and Indigenous women, and because they were all kind of marginalized, homeless, poverty, maybe drugs involved, that, you know, we sometimes attack our own people in our own communities because we feel so disenfranchised.
Yeah. When you look into the research on bullying, it's really clear the difference between the standard bullying that goes on between boys and the bullying between girls, right? And the bullying between boys is pushing, shoving, kicking, and one-upmanship. But within girls, it's the desire or the attempt to smear their character, to get people to not like them anymore, to pull away from them socially. So it's more of a social bullying, the mean girl syndrome, that's social bullies. It's attacking reputation and popularity and character versus pushing, shoving, kicking, which is how boys
And cyberbullying. There was a young woman that came on TV and Canadian documentary a few years ago apologizing and crying because she and her female classmates were bullying this young woman. I forget why. Cyberbullying. And that young woman ended up committing suicide. This was a teenager in high school. Cyberbullying is so huge.
It really is. Rupert, I'd love to have you tell us just some more about your memoirs. You mentioned one in 2017, one in 2020. What was the catalyst, right, for putting down your stories? And what information did you choose to include? And what did you leave out? And what was the process like for you putting that all together, these two different books?
Wow, that's a lot of questions, but good ones. Yes, I started writing in 1985, but then I left it off because I got too busy trying to just survive paying my bills. Because, you know, writing takes a lot of time, as you know. And the only time I really started writing, quite other than the clinical research papers that I wrote when I had my master's and so on, or after I got my master's. Well, actually, I didn't really have much time until I retired to really, really spend time. So I wanted to combine the personal and the political. When I say political, I mean activism. You could also say I'm a trans social historian. So I wanted to present history, trans, not just trans, but the wider two-spirit, hijra, intersex, non-binary, trans women, trans men, everything. I wanted to present some of the culture and history in Canada, the US, and Europe. I couldn't do everybody, and hijra I mentioned. And I also wanted to talk about my personal relationships with trans men and trans women and cis women, because I've been married twice. I've had a number of trans and cis partners and lovers. I wanted to blend in that with the activism and then with the academic stuff that I was doing and then the schooling I was doing. Because in those days, as I guess now, for a lot of people, it's mixed together, because often you'll see an academic who's an activist, or if they're not an academic, they write. So anyway, the personal and the political, and that's what the feminists say. They say, oh, the personal is the political. I think Gloria Steinem said it. And then this Indigenous person, and I forgot their name and I'm trying to find it. They said all Indigenous art is political. And I think there's something in that. And I'm putting together with two Indigenous organizations I've recently connected with. I'm trying to work with an Indigenous publisher here and get some funding to put forth a book anthology of poetry, short story, and artwork by Indigenous people on Vancouver Island. And a number of them are trans, queer, or two-spirit. Anyway, that's beside the point. It took me a year and a half to do my first memoir. I was under some great stress because my laptop died halfway through, and I could only do so much on my iPad because I didn't have the Word, MS Word, like in its full functionality. So I was very much restricted, and I had to wait almost 2 weeks to get my computer back, and I was sweating buckets because we were moving to Mexico, my partner and I, the end of August. And so I was under a deadline. I was working with Kindle Publishing, KDP, Kindle Direct Publishing, which is an arm of Amazon, because I was trying to work with Tristan Cotton, Transgress Press, but it didn't work out. And it's just as well, because he had a page restriction of, I think, 170 pages. And my book ended up being almost twice that, because I wanted to add on all the end notes and the bibliography. And I wanted to really flesh it out, because it was an intellectual biography, but it was also a socio-political historical. So I was combining all of that. So I couldn't do that in 170 pages. Anyway, so that's why I went self-publishing. So there's a lot of stress. I finally got it published, but unfortunately we didn't get the index done because I guess we ran out of time. And, you know, it's, if you've ever tried to do an index, so for trans activism in Canada that Dan Irving and I did through Canadian Scholars Press in 2014, we hired a person to do the indexing. We had 25 chapters for that book with 45 contributors across Canada. And it's really well reviewed and it sells quite well. It's $90 now for the paper version. So, and then I did my second memoir in 2020 with Margot Wilson, Transgender Publishing, which is now called Perceptions Press, because I was hoping to do the index again, but unfortunately we didn't get to it because I was leaving for Portugal and Margot was leaving for South America right in the end of 2019. So we were under like a deadline because I wanted to get this off my plate before I left, because even though I can write when I'm in another country, I can't really write something really, 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 really big because it's hard for me to focus if I'm in another country trying to travel and learning a new culture. And whereas if I'm at home home, I don't need to travel or learn a new culture, and I have more opportunity to spend. So I wrote my second book, let's see, I started it in 2016 after I did my founders panel at the Moving Trans History Forward Conference in Victoria with Erin DeVore. After that, I met Margot there, Wilson there, and I thought, oh, I'm going to start. I asked her if she would publish my memoir, which I was going to do it when I was 70, but I decided to do it when I was 68. So 3 years later. So she agreed. So then I started working on it right away. And so that's when I expanded the first one by adding stuff onto the end notes, the bibliography, and including new people. And she was kind of getting upset because I had all these last minute revisions, including last minute new people, emergent trans activists and artists that I really wanted to foreground. My book could have easily been 500 or 1,000 pages because I'm the networker supreme. I'm the resource man and I network with people all over. I mean, not quite as much now. I don't do Twitter, Instagram, and very little Facebook, but I do lots of emails, as you know, and I do Zoom. So even without doing that other stuff, I'm still one of the bigger networkers. I don't know all the new stuff, but I met a number of young trans people in the States and Canada that are doing their doctorates or they're doing postdoctoral work, and they Zoom with me because they see my fonds at the archives in Toronto or in Victoria. And I like to mentor. That's one of the things I like to do. Is to, when I was a counselor, a therapist at Sherbourne, a registered therapist, I would mentor the new people around trans and queer stuff, you know, and I learn from them. I learn from my clients, my colleagues. It's a mutual exchange, but I like to mentor these students, and I get people from Germany, Portugal, and Finland, Belgium, Canada, the US, Britain. I had a Belgian non-binary person just here a couple of weeks. Oh, I told you about that a couple of weeks ago because they were doing research at my archives in Toronto and in Victoria and the Kinsey Institute in Bloomington, Indiana, because they're writing their PhD on early trans healthcare in the United States and Canada. That's their thesis.
We will be taking our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Rupert Raj. Rupert is a Eurasian Canadian trans elder, pioneering community activist, former therapist, and gender consultant, published author, memoirist, and poet. Don't go away. We'll be back shortly.
Radio. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. We are grateful to our sponsor, the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, IICS. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Keg, and our guest this hour is Rupert Raj. Let's get back to the show.
Wow. So you're still, I mean, we often think of this idea of a pioneer as somebody who in the past did something before a lot of other people were doing it, or popularized something, or made inroads into something. But we don't often think of a person as a pioneer who is perhaps still living and still engaging, right? Still doing the same work, not at the same volume, which makes sense, but it's wonderful that people are still finding out about you, still able to connect with you. You're making time to spend with these people and providing them with probably in the most valuable parts of the information, right? Because it's one thing to read something, it's one thing to watch something, but to meet a person and hear firsthand stories and experiences, it just contributes at such a deeper level. So yeah. I just want to thank you, right? As a trans man, like, thank you for all of your pioneering work and for bringing that work forward and influencing countless people that you probably don't even know who have done other work. We don't always acknowledge whose shoulders we're standing on when we're doing our work. Sometimes we don't know, but sometimes we do know and we still don't do it. And maybe that's that weird competition thing. But I just want to say thank you, because it's quite remarkable. And it's, you've basically left breadcrumb trails for people to follow. That's wonderful. And I really appreciate it.
And thank you for your wonderful work. And I just want to urge people to please donate to archives and don't leave it. Do it now. So all the archives you can think of that you are willing to donate. I know you sent your copy of your book from Dyke to Dude to the Trans Ottawa Library, the only one in Canada that's an independent trans library. So I've donated to 3 archives in Canada, 2 special collections in Canada, and 2 archives in the U.S. or 3 archives in the U.S., including K.J. Rawson's Digital Transgender Archive, which, of course, is very accessible. I mean, some are more accessible than others. And doing oral podcasts, like the one you're doing, and the oral LGBTQ Collaboratory Digital Archives videos that Elspeth Brown does from Toronto with Evan from British Columbia on the UVic archives. Yeah, the archives and special collection libraries. Please, any trans activists or academic, non-binary, two-spirit, intersex, please donate. Donate now. Don't leave it till too late. There was 2 early trans women in their 80s that I wanted to talk to, but they both have Alzheimer's, so now they cannot remember stuff they did with me or back then. But luckily, they donated to the Gay Archives in Montreal and or the one in Toronto. So some of their stuff is there, thankfully, because this is what can happen to any of us. I mean, I'm lucky. I'll be 74 in February. I don't have memory issues right now, but you never know. So we can't leave it till too late.
Yeah. Yeah. Within the United States, we have multiple options for people. So definitely, you know, look up things like archives, look up like GLBT archives. There's the GLBT Historical Archives in San Francisco. There's also, we have an oral history project here called Outwards that has spent the last couple of years interviewing trans people. I know Jude Patton is one of the people that was interviewed in the last couple of years. And then he threw my name in their hat. And so they interviewed me, and that's now live. And so I know that there are many others, and they're continuing. They also have a podcast now, and I think they're focusing on trans people. Although it looks like it was all trans women and non-binary people, there were no trans men. And I did send them a comment about hoping that that would be different in their second year.
Kai and Jackal's Stealth Productions, which I did a podcast for them recently. And Sky Sizigi just sent me, who moved from New York to Riverside, California, just sent me registration for Trans Conference May 13th to 15th in Chicago, both online and in person. Yeah, it's so much going on now. Oh,
so,
and here's a book I just wanted to tell you about. It's called Out North, an archive of queer activism and kinship in Canada, produced by the archives in Toronto in 2020. And there's stuff on me in there and Marisol A. Ross and not very many trans people. So I'm hoping to do a similar book like this in a couple of years that just focuses on trans, intersex, two-spirit, non-binary in Canada.
That's fantastic. Well, Rupert, what would you like to share with our listeners? Do you have any places you'd like them to go? You can just say the names of some places online.
I really want to focus on the intergenerational piece. I starting a network at Sherburn with my Black, queer, trans, genderqueer friend and intergenerational LGBT network. Unfortunately, I had to go have my surgery, my bottom surgery in Montreal in 2012 when I was 60. And they had then took 3 months off. And when I got back, they went off for 3 months and no one else would pick it up. This is the problem. Same with metamorphosis. We don't have enough sustainability to pass on the baton. So I think we need to, well, two things. The intergenerational piece, apparently in the UK and even in the US, they're further ahead than Canada, but we're catching up with that. It's okay to have youth focused or elderly focused stuff, but we also need to come together intergenerational, both print, in person, online. We really need to get funding and foster that and break down that siloing of, oh, you're youth and you're elderly and you're. The other thing is mentoring people. Whatever we do, academia, counseling, social work, healthcare, education, faith community, whatever, we need to try to build that. And not to ask people for money. This is like, I don't ask people when I do mentoring, I do it for free. But I mean, if some people need to, if that's their business, that's different. If they're a professional consultant and need the money. The other thing is sustainability, train the trainer model. I was doing a train the trainer model at the 519 Church Street Community Center, which is now just called the 519 in Toronto, with three trans men, because I designed and delivered three workshops for older trans men and their loved ones. And so I was wanting to make it a train-the-trainer workshop because I was leaving Toronto to move eventually away. So that's what we need to do. Like when we do our trainings, let's not hold them to ourselves. I mean, we can have our name on it, but let's do it as a train-the-trainer model so that other people can take it and change and customize it to their use.
Thank you, Rupert.
Thank you, Dr. Goldbauer, and thank you, Zander.
We have reached the end of the Umbrella Hour. You are listening to Rupert Raj, our guest for this hour. We hope that you enjoyed the history of this current and very active pioneer. Until next time, thank you for listening.